Okay, so it's been a long week, right? Would everyone agree? Okay, we've talked about the Equifax breach, preserving Southern food heritage, and the region's Latino boom. So what we've done is what we do every week around here. We've gathered a group of smart people. Well, hang on, let me look around the room.
Look out.
We have gathered a group of mostly smart people.
Are you looking in the mirror, Tony?
To help us kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened this week, it is time for The Break Room.
Violent protests broke out at Georgia Tech in Atlanta. The turmoil followed a vigil last night for student Scout Schultz. A university police officer shot and killed the 21-year-old Saturday.
A teacher in South Carolina has been suspended for asking her students to, wait for it, justify the existence of the KKK.
And the Emmy goes to Donald Glover, Atlanta!
Oh, this is the first Emmy winner book nomination for Donald Glover!
So joining us in the break room now, our farmer, John Jackson, who is with us via Skype. We also have Fayette County Commissioner Steve Brown, Natalie Pavelski of Cater Communications, and Nasenga Burton, who chairs Mass Media Arts at Clark Atlanta University. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Hey, great to be here.
So we talked earlier about Atlanta's population boom, and I know you got some thoughts on that, but here's something that we're interested in. It turns out that Georgia is now the 13th most diverse state in the nation, and I guess my question is, Steve, let me start with you. Is it just Atlanta where we're seeing this kind of rich diversity, or is it throughout the state?
Well, I mean, the interesting part of this study for me was you see a lot of the diversity in the suburbs, you know, out in Johns Creek and Roswell, Sandy Springs. Those are all suburban areas. I would have thought it would have been more centralized than Atlanta and possibly Decatur. I was kind of shocked with the way it turned out. And in rural areas, you've got a Hispanic population, but beyond that, there's really not a lot of diversity between the communities, between the traditional black and white areas that you have in those agricultural communities.
So let's go to our resident farmer on the line with this from Skype. John, what are your thoughts on this question?
I thought it was really interesting. We have an on-site farmers market that we do twice a month, and the folks that I get to the farmers market range from Latino, Muslim, blacks, and good old country boys. And one of the things that I really like about this is when these guys come to meet at our farmers market, I mean, the conversations and the camaraderie in the community is just amazing. It's one of our highlights of the actual week, getting together and serving the community that way.
You know, Nasenga, folks have got to move into some of these outlying areas. It just can't be an Atlanta thing, and the diversity has to be pretty widespread. You heard some of the numbers that were cited in our A section today, and there are a lot of people on their way to the South and to Atlanta in particular.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I just moved here from the D.C. area, the DMV, as we call it now, which I'm so old, I didn't even know what that was. but I'm not surprised by that level of diversity, especially in a city, in places as close to Atlanta as they are. It's very well known. It's internationally known place. It's been very diverse for a very long time. I live in Decatur. We were just talking about that offline. I see no, very few people that look like me in Decatur, and I'm a black woman from the South.
Yeah.
So I found the numbers to be refreshing. I was a little bit surprised, like Steve, about Atlanta, and that Decatur wasn't on that list. But yeah, I mean, if you want to be in the South and you want to be in a place where I feel that people of color and religious who have religious diversity are welcome, then I think this is a good state to think about it.
Natalie, weigh in on this.
Well, I'm right in the heart of Atlanta. I live in Midtown Atlanta.
Okay.
I moved down in 1990. And I've seen a huge change, because when I first moved down, it was like I'd meet people here and they thought I was exotic for having a name that ended in a vowel and being raised Catholic, you know. And those days are long gone. And it's really interesting that it's diversity beyond black and white. We have new immigrant groups. We have different religious groups moving in. It's really exciting to see.
Yeah. Speaking of diversity, let's continue on this. Georgia's Donald Glover of FX TV show Atlanta. Made history on Sunday, right? He won two Emmys for the show. One made him the first black director to win for a comedy series. The first black director. Think about that for a second. Other trailblazers at the ceremony include Riz Ahmed, the first South Asian man to win an Emmy for acting.
And Muslim.
And Muslim, right? Lena Waithe, the first African-American woman to win an Emmy for comedy writing. Here is a bit of her acceptance speech.
The things that make us different
Those are superpowers. Every day when you walk out the door, put on your imaginary cape and go out there and conquer the world, because the world would not be as beautiful as it is if we weren't in it. And for everybody out there that showed us so much love for this episode, thank you for embracing a little Indian boy from South Carolina and a little queer black girl from the south side of Chicago. We appreciate it more than you could ever know.
Why does it feel, Natalie, I'll come to you on this one first. Why does it feel that TV, at least recently, we should add here, seems to be so much better at diversifying than the movies?
I think there's a few things at work here. First of all, TV's a lot cheaper to produce and faster. I mean, you don't have projects getting stuck in turnaround for a decade and a half. So it can be a lot more responsive to the kind of changes we've just been talking about that are in our society. And since there's less at stake financially, companies are willing to be more innovative with it, I think. There's also audience fragmentation. Mm-hmm. I mean, it used to be that there were only three networks and you kind of had to appeal to some, you know, generic version of middle America. You don't have to do that anymore. You don't have to appeal to all of America to have a very successful program.
And John, to the extent that, you know, television more reflects the diversity in our population, that feels like a good thing, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. But, you know, I'm being honest with you. I know I'm going to ruffle some feathers with this. You know, the real question is, you know, why do we have to mention race when his work is good or just that, you know, or just good? No, I don't want to receive consideration because I don't want him to receive consideration because he's black. You know, I want him to receive consideration because his work is awesome. You know, I personally feel it takes away from his work when we mention race or any minority who's done a really good job, because it places a cloud over the award that may suggest, you know, they may receive it because they were black and not good. You know, I'm thinking, hey, give them the reward, give them the award because they're just good, period, end of line.
Isn't that what happened here?
Because you acknowledge what your identity is doesn't take anything away. I think it actually adds value, particularly in a televisual and filmic landscape that has been predominantly white, predominantly straight, predominantly male, and still is, if you look at behind the scenes. And so I think it's good when people actually acknowledge what their backgrounds are so that they can say, like, listen, we should be working. You know, Shonda Rhimes wrote a piece on Shondaland where she was like, yeah, it is embarrassing when we're still in 2017 saying we have the first black this, the first Muslim that, because we should be so far ahead. So that's the embarrassment. The embarrassment is not saying that it's a black man who won this award and he should be, you know, we should, that presents a cloud. The fact that he's black actually adds value to the televisual landscape and hopefully will open doors for other black people in this traditionally white, male, straight industry that has engaged in, let me say this, discriminatory practices. You know, so I'm a PhD in cinema television. My area of expertise is race, class, gender, and sexuality. So, and if you look at the data, back to Tony's original point, the data would suggest that it is time for these things to start happening because the audiences aren't as monolithic as they used to be or they used to be. And the data has always shown that people of color have watched at least 33% of television programming. Mm-hmm. So they should have been doing this for a very long time.
And as TV shows get more diverse, Hollywood keeps recycling, right? Ugh. Just this year we've seen, or avoided, the sequels to Pirates of the Caribbean, Spider-Man, the Planet of the Apes, and now director, did you hear this? James Cameron, Steve, plans to make another Terminator movie.
I'm a friend of Sarah Connor. I was told that she's here. Could I see her, please?
No, can't see her. She's making a statement.
Where is she?
Look, it may take a while. You want to wait? There's a bench over there.
I'll be back.
And he is.
Steve?
But you know, here's what bothers me is you've got an industry that's the most creative industry in the United States, possibly the world, and they're telling everyone there are no more good ideas. We can't come up with a single original idea for a new movie.
Yeah. James Cameron is set to release, what, 3 or 4 more Avatar movies? Oh, God. I mean, come on. I read a headline that says the new Terminator movie officially seals James Cameron's fate as a has-been.
And
Natalie,
this is this
do you
is
want
one
to see
of,
another
no.
Terminator movie?
No, I disagree.
I mean,
with that.
I don't even know if I saw the first one. I mean, this is one of the most, you know, he's broken a lot of the molds in Hollywood. This is a guy who's very creative, but it's not creative to just rehash the same old idea for the 493rd time. A lot of movies have a second or even a third. I'm thinking Godfather 2, Toy Story 3. I mean, those were all right, but do we really need to be rehashing the Terminator saga?
Miss Link, I feel like you want to say something here.
Yeah, so this is why television, another reason that television is more diverse, because as you said, the speed, the different channels, the technology would suggest that. Hollywood, really only 8 checks are written in Hollywood, and they are really bottom line driven. So there's no subscription base, for instance, as we have with cable, right? So they're bottom line driven. So they keep making movies because they know that if Avatar 1 through 5 made $500 million worldwide, then they can do that again. And they're not really focused on the American market anymore. They're focused on getting movies out. They're going to get the people who are followers of James Cameron and Avatar and all of those movies, Terminator, and then they're going to dump it off in the international markets, and that's where they're going to make the bulk of their money. So it's not really about programming and creativity as it is about business. So if you understand that Hollywood is a business, and that also feeds into the diversity issue and challenges, then you understand why they make some of the what appear to be poor decisions to us, but they actually are very good business decisions.
Yeah, Baby Driver made money. I mean, Mother, I didn't see it, but I guess it made... Boy, you worked that over really well, Nisanga. Thank you. All right, we're just getting started. It's Friday.
She is a professional.
And we are in the break room. Just ahead, Taco Bell adds booze to its menu. And listen to this. A teacher comes under fire for a lesson about racism in the classroom. A break, and we're back. This is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. This is On Second Thought. We are having coffee and conversation. If we had food, we could do a chat and chew in the break room, as we do every Friday. My guests today are Farmer John Jackson, Fayette County Commissioner Steve Brown, Natalie Pavelski of Cater Communications, and Nisanga Burton, who chairs Mass Media Arts at Clark Atlanta University. Sad story here. The shooting last weekend of a Georgia Tech student on campus is still being reviewed by the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. GBI says 21-year-old Scout Schultz called 911 about a suspicious person on campus with a knife and possibly a gun. That description matched Schultz. When he didn't drop a blade in his hand, he was shot to death. The officer who fired is now on paid leave. A Schultz family attorney told reporters Schultz had been suffering a mental breakdown at the time of the confrontation. John, let me come to you on this. What went wrong here in your estimation, and what maybe can the school learn from this tragedy?
You know, I'm a veteran. I deal with we deal with returning vets coming back with committing suicide, and one of the things that I really look closely to with suicide by cops, which we go through a lot, is that, you know, it appears that Scout was on a suicide mission, and when he reached the cops, it was really a point of no return. So, you know, the cops, they have the right to defend themselves for what they perceive as a threat. But I think that the first line defense is not 911 or the police. I think it's the friends and family and his circle around him that are actually looking for cues that are changing his behavior. Those are the folks that really raise the alarm to address those issues. And I think the school need to make sure that we have an environment where we are starting engaging with folks to start looking for those signs. I mean, more awareness and more education on this issue would help. It's certainly helping the veterans community.
You know, I don't think American police should always be using lethal force in a non-lethal situation. This was not a big knife. This was a little tiny folded pocket knife.
Is there video on this?
And the thing is, this was a new officer, and to something that John said, he hadn't had crisis intervention training. And he hadn't been issued non-lethal options. You know, where's the taser? And if you're going to shoot him, why do you have to shoot him in the heart? Shoot him in the leg. He wasn't equipped with, a submachine gun or something. This was a tiny little knife.
I didn't watch the video. I just don't want to, you know, I just don't want to watch that kind of thing. But, Steve, there are law enforcement agencies, police forces around the country, and I'm thinking of the Camden Police Department in particular because I spent some time with them, that work really hard on de-escalating situations mm-hmm. like this. Was there a possibility here, from what you know about the story, to de-escalate this situation?
Well, I mean, you know, as somebody who's had a police department under them and a sheriff's office and various other yep. things like this, I have a great deal of empathy for both sides of this. You've got a guy who's struggling for his sanity here, who's on the verge of, you know, trying to have somebody kill him.
Yeah.
You've got an officer who's been thrust into this situation and who is... And if you listen to the audio, I think it was a dozen times he was begging the guy, drop the knife, drop the knife, drop the knife. But the way they're trained, 31 feet is the hazard point. Mm-hmm. And if that person encroaches 31 feet.
With a little knife even?
That's what they, with a weapon of lethal impact, 31 feet is what they look at. And that's where you can then inflict harm on the officer. And the goal is not to let the officer... injured. We're not paying them $30,000 a year to put their lives on the line for something with in that scenario. So.
But if they're going to respond to a tiny knife with a gunshot to the heart, if they're going to be that freaked out by it, maybe they're in the wrong profession.
Yeah. I mean, you have to remember, if you've got somebody coming at you too, though, it's one of these situations where you're not really aiming for a leg or an arm, because if you miss, the knife is coming at you. I just have a great deal of empathy for both sides. I mean, I feel bad for the guy and his family, but that officer is in a situation where none of us would want to be in that spot. You couldn't pay me to be in that spot.
Absolutely.
So... police officers are trained to shoot to kill, and I think people need to know that. I grew up with a bunch of police officers, and they are trained to shoot to kill. So they're not trained to shoot to stop you or to, you know, hurt you a little bit. They're trained to shoot to kill.
And but maybe that's what needs to change.
I don't disagree. I don't disagree with you. I think it should change. But I think people need to know that, you know, just because they have, because the idea is that, oh, they have this expertise, people who are in the service, people who are in the police department. And so because they have that expertise and we don't have that expertise, then they should kind of dole it out in a certain way. That's the intellectual response to it. But the reality is that they're trained to shoot to kill. And if you come within that 31 feet, mm-hmm. it's over. So we have to educate the public about that. Now, in terms of mental health and mental illness on college campuses, mm-hmm. that is actually rampant on college campuses. And they have been actually doing a lot. And I'm sure that Georgia Tech has been doing a lot to inform the public and the faculty and the staff and what have you. But I think in terms of killing students, that is a major issue. And we have to always figure out how to de-escalate and maybe to change some of those rules, because we have a lot of students that struggle with mental illness. And if we're going to shoot all of them, we're going to be shooting a lot of students.
Well, yeah. And science shows that that a teenage brain isn't fully cooked yet. I mean, you don't have full control over yourself yet in a lot of cases.
Nasenka, let me come back to you on mm-hmm. this one. Mm-hmm. A South Carolina fifth grade teacher asked her students this question. You are a member of the KKK. Why do you think your treatment of African Americans is justified? Okay, so the teacher has been suspended. Is that a proper topic for grade schoolers? What are you, 9, 10 years old?
Can I say hell no on GPB?
I think you just did.
Oh, okay. All right. Just wanted to make sure. You know, it's not about not talking about the KKK. We need to talk about the KKK. We need to talk about issues of race. We need to talk about a whole bunch of things. But there is something that is called being age appropriate, right? And so you can tell fifth graders, you know, kids are very bright. They're very resilient. They bounce back. They get sad when they hear information, but they come right back. You can tell kids the truth about a whole lot of things without having a 10-year-old and 9-year-old debating the merits of the KKK or why they should exist or not. That is completely age inappropriate, and that is just an asinine thing to do. And I really take exception to it, because I, you know, most of the stories I read, and you all can correct me because you all read as much as I do, always involve, you know, black kids, KKK, slavery, let's reimagine slavery. And it's always elementary school students. So I'm like, why do teachers think it is appropriate to do this to our kids?
Okay, so John, let me come to you. I'm going to try to, this won't work, but I'm going to do it anyway. do we think the teacher thought this would be an interesting thought exercise? Okay, you can't get into the teacher's mind on this. To show how people justify terrible behavior? I mean, Do we think that this teacher was trying to, in some way, shape, or form, indoctrinate?
I have to go with the last comment more so than anything. That suggests maybe it's more indoctrination than to actually teach. It seems more like let's condition with these type of questions. And I kind of feel that these are the type of things that adds fuel to the fire for when these kids grow up later on, you know, in a generation of hate, you know, and spewing a lot of this stuff. These teachers should be looking at different ways on trying to instill values. I'm all about love, you know, with what Dr. Martin Luther King talked about. We know that there's racism. We know that there's a lot of these things, but the KKK is irrelevant. I mean, they're small. They are the minority. Mm. And the best way to counter them is to teach, you know, is to teach diversity, to teach tolerance and love. That's it.
Yeah. Families moving to a new community. This is something new, and I've totally missed this. They're looking for great schools, obviously, and they're also looking for a really good deal on a home. Atlanta's now a hub, apparently, for three huge startups that allow you to buy and sell. You like this. Okay.
Yes.
That's Nsanga. cheering this, applauding this. That allow you to buy or sell a home quickly online. You don't even need a realtor to do this.
Look at these windows. My plants are going to love it here.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're taking all the windows with us.
Nsanga, why do you think this is a you like this? Why do you think this is such a good idea? And it's hot. Clearly, it's hot.
I like competition. And I like for people to have to work for their money. And I have a fantastic realtor, by the way. I love her. I do not want her put out of business by any way, in any way, shape, or form.
Is there a possibility of that here?
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime,
it's
anything.
It's disruptive.
Yes,
right?
It's disruptive, or you know, disrupts the current status quo in terms of how money is made, how houses are sold and bought and marketed, or what have you. There's always a possibility of what I call human carnage, i.e., the loss of jobs. Having said that, though, I think that it's always good when people have an opportunity, if they want, to participate in a marketplace, and to, especially as it involves homes, the sell of their home. And so I think that this is a good thing in terms of opportunities that it will present for people who actually want to engage and not really engage third parties or realtors. And then the crazy process that is buying a house.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, got to go to our county commissioner on this.
Well, you know, the interesting part about this was I've done a mortgage loan. I've done a car loan on the internet. But, you know, you still have banks. You still have mortgage brokers. They're still on the street. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's going to disrupt the industry to the point where you don't have realtors anymore.
Right.
But the one thing that really got me was that you could use, they could give you a code and you could go into that person's house without the realtor. And the realtor's always kind of been the objective set of eyes, making sure that nothing gets stolen from your home while mm-hmm. people are going in and out of your home. That creeps me out a little bit, having people in my home, you know, mm-hmm. just with a 4-digit code.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you know, so, and then buying a house sight unseen. I read where some of people are going out there, they're not even seeing the house. They're buying it off the internet. And I couldn't do that.
Are these actual people who want to live in those homes or people who are in buying these things for investment properties?
Well, I'm sure
probably
it's
a bit of both.
It's probably a little bit of both. I mean, I could see if I lived in Seattle and I had to buy a home in Atlanta. Yes, there's probably an advantage of me being able to get on the internet and do a lot of advanced work and things of that nature. But even then, I would still have to set foot in that home.
Natalie, would you buy a home? Something as big, as significant in your life as a home online?
Oh, God, no, I have to kick the tires. But we did buy our house without a realtor. I mean, that you can do even now because you can do all the shopping yourself.
Right.
Selling is a harder thing. I think in theory, if there's a way to make the whole process a little more seamless, that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. But in practice, I will note that all of these services seem to charge the magic 6%. Anyway, if they're really going to disrupt it, they need to be cheaper than the traditional commissions.
Well, John, I'm going to come to you on this one. The Atlanta Falcons, 2-0 Atlanta Falcons, by the way, are away this weekend facing the Detroit Lions. And that's a good ball club, too. But if you've been to the Mercedes-Benz Stadium, have you guys been to the stadium?
Not yet.
Yes.
Not yet?
I have.
It's gorgeous.
Yes, it's wonderful.
You then noticed kind of a vast improvement in food prices. The prices actually went down. For example, hot dogs that were $5.50 are now $2.
I'm sure you have a good explanation for where you were.
The best. I was eating hot dogs.
Hot dogs? That is so stupid. It must be the truth.
Hey, John, have you been to the new stadium? And what do you think about the fact that at least the pricing on the food seems to be more fan and family friendly?
Well, I mean, honestly, you know, I have my own football team, and, you know, if the price of food is coming down, I may consider, you know, bringing all the kids. But but I'm more concerned about if they're beef or pork hot dogs. I can't eat a pork hot dog. So.
We didn't see that coming.
I wondered if there's beef or pork in any of them. Yeah, if they're only charging $2, what's in that hot dog?
What's in the hot dog? But that's it really is, Natalie, an attempt to. I thought when I heard this initially, the idea is we'll do it. It's an introductory thing, and you know the prices will go back to what we're used to in a year or so. But apparently, there is a real concerted effort to keep these prices in this range.
Oh, I think it's great. I think it's, you know, tickets and parking are so expensive, and the security rules are a pain in the backside. This is a little break, a little thank you, glad you're here, sorry we blew the Super Bowl kind of gesture.
Nice. Well, how expensive? I haven't been down there yet. I mean, for a football game, Atlanta United is virtually selling out. We know the Falcons are going to. So what are your thoughts on, you know, this attempt to try to give families and parents a bit of a break?
I think it's about time. In terms of all sports, really, it's really cost prohibitive. You have to really save if you are a family. I would say of like four or more, it's almost impossible unless you're in, like, you make a lot of money because the tickets are so expensive or what have you. So I think that the food prices are cheaper. I think it's also going to attract people because sometimes it's like, yeah, I can afford a ticket. It's like going to the movies, right? I can afford a ticket to the movies, but I can't afford the popcorn and the candy because that's another $20. I think it's the same thing or same idea with the football stadium. It's like, okay, I just paid $250 for these tickets. Now I can go eat for $10. That's good. But now I have to go pay another $50 to $100 to eat. Mm-hmm. That's bad.
Yeah, and Taco Bell. You see this news this week, Taco Bell?
Goodness. Can I say hell again? Hell no.
Here we go.
All right, let me tee you up for that. Can I tee you up for that properly? So Taco Bell announces a major change. It plans to serve alcohol at 300 locations and close the drive-thrus at those locations. Marketing Marvel, dubious decision. Nasenga, you say?
Hell no.
No. Taco Bell is more of a place you go after you've had a few drinks.
Yes.
Well, Tony, you got to point out, too, that 70% of Taco Bell's business is through the drive-thru. So what are you doing? You're saying, I want a bean burrito and a large margarita to go, and then you're going to drive on I-285?
That sounds good. Okay, I take it back.
No. Well, Steve, you've got to, I would think you would, I mean, look, there are fees attached, there are liquor licenses involved here. I mean, are you looking for this kind of an operation, Taco Bell, and these in-store restaurants with alcohol and liquor served in Fayette County?
You know, I would think, I've always thought of, you know, maybe this is my personal bias, but I've always thought of Taco Bell as being kind of the lower end of the fast food Mexican. If I want a margarita, I usually go to a Mexican restaurant.
Yeah. Right.
You know, don't give it to the people who are going through the drive-thru 70% of the time, please, dear God.
And John, come on. I mean, this is called, what are they calling this? They're calling this urban inline cantina-style stores.
That right
well,
there.
I think the real problem is that their board meeting needs to stop having alcohol at the board meeting. That's, you know, honest, because this is probably the dumbest idea that I've heard.
Well, that seems like a sufficient enough place to leave this for this week. That was well done. We are flat out of time for the break room today. Thanks to all of my guests, Farmer John Jackson on Skype with us, Fayette County Commissioner Steve Brown, Natalie Pavelski of Cater Communications, and Nasenga Burton, who chairs Mass Media Arts at Clark Atlanta University. What a good week. Thank you all.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you, yes.
That's on Second Thought. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Tony Harris, in for Celeste Headley.